This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing a talk given a few weeks ago by a former analyst for the CIA, Lisa Ruth. She spoke on the subject of conflicts in the Middle East, and specifically if American covert action could have prevented the violence and turmoil we see there today. Since leaving the CIA, Lisa Ruth works as a journalist for the media organization Communities Digital News and contributes to Newsmax and other publications. She writes extensively on intelligence, world affairs, and breaking news. On October 7th, she made a case for how covert action might have worked to stabilize Libya and Syria. She also spoke about Russia's involvement in the Syrian conflict. Her talk was recorded before last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. This is Lisa Ruth.
When the CIA was started, and I have to be very careful because we have a foreign service officer here who can, like, raise her eyebrows at us. When CIA was started, there was this idea, we've got diplomacy, and we've got war. And intelligence types said, but we need something in between. We want something in between the hammer and the carrot. And covert action is what we came up with. So now you guys may be familiar with a few minor embarrassment things like, oh, the Bay of Pigs, Chile, you know, Allende. Those were covert action. But there's other kinds of covert action. Covert action is what we use when we want to influence policy, but we don't want to go, hi, I'm with the State Department, and we'd really like you to vote for our guy. And we also don't want to send in the military. So covert action can look like something. Do you guys, anybody journalists at all, write? You guys write at all? Outside of, right, journalism. We love journalists. Journalists can be covert action, right? If I write an article saying about how great Assad is in Syria, and I publish it all over the world, people start going, you know that Assad guy? Who knew he was such a humanitarian? You can start impacting the way people think. Anybody who watches the news now, when's the last time you guys saw an unbiased news report? Right? Not anymore. I listen to Fox and they scream at each other. I can't watch that. I can't watch CNN. So it isn't. It's not about delivering the news anymore, right? AP, NPR maybe. But they're pushing you to think something. Think about that next time you guys are reading sources and watching the news. So covert action. Anybody know what the church committee is? Oh, yeah. No, yes. What happened was after Watergate, and turned out the CIA was, bugging people we weren't supposed to be bugging, church committee came out and said, you can't do this. You can't do this. So one of the things they got rid of was political covert action. And I know you all are going, yeah, right, sure they did. No, but they really did. And what that meant is we as the CIA could no longer intentionally go in and use political tools to change opinion. We could still use journalism, kind of carefully. But what we couldn't do is, all right, let's pretend there is something going on in the U.S. right now, okay? We have this lovely campaign going on. If you're Putin, has anybody looked at the tweets that are coming out of Moscow right now? Anybody see what they're saying about the candidates? It's really interesting. Every one of them talks about how great Donald Trump is. I am not kidding. It's an interesting thing to do. Social media has changed, by the way, the whole covert action, but read it. Why would they be doing that? Yeah, they're trying to build, and they're saying things like, oh boy, we are so afraid of Donald Trump because he'll be really tough on us. Gosh. I have a good friend who is a former KGB officer, and I was Skyping with him the other day, and he said, those guys are sitting around crossing their fingers. Please, please, please put Trump in power. And that is true. And they can all tell you their reasoning. And when I'm in Costa Rica, you guys can tell me your reasoning, too, if he wins. But they're doing their own covert action. There are ways to do that. Now, we have also, as the CIA, gone a little bit further than tweets, right? So one of the things that we used to do was, if it was looking at the U.S., and if we wanted Donald Trump to win, what we would do is start training his people. We would educate him. We would look at voter lists and say, here's how you want to motivate these people to support you. Here's how you want to win. Now, you could also argue, that's kind of not really fair, right? I mean, the U.S. shouldn't be involved. Except then the question is, and we can debate this later, but does the United States, if we're not out there rigging the ballot box, how much right do we have to influence? And at the time, before 1973, we thought, okay, that's legitimate. You guys can play that way. We cannot do that anymore. So I know we said the topic was whether it could save the Middle East, and that might be a little bit of an oversell. So we'll stick with, could it have helped with stability in some Middle Eastern countries? And the two I'm going to talk about are Libya and Syria, because they're the worst right now. All right, you guys know what's going on in Libya?
The military, right?
Well, it's not the military. The military's in charge of some places. The militias are in charge of some places. ISIS is now in charge of some places, right? I have friends who live there, and they tell me going out on the street every day is a crapshoot. Because you leave your house, you don't know if you're going to be able to get water or food. You don't know what the roads are going to look like. You don't know if people are going to be in the street saying, you're not going here today. All right? There's no rebuilding. They were supposed to rebuild after. That kind of didn't happen. Unemployment is off the charts. So what's happening is you're creating an atmosphere where there's more and more radical ideology, because people can't work. They don't have anything else. And the only people who are providing services are al-Nusra is in there now. ISIS is in there. Al-Qaeda certainly is in there. I have a very, very, very good friend, but he's a little bit crazy. And he is with one of the militias there now trying to help. And what he says, he swears to me, if the United States had done political covert action when Gaddafi was falling, Libya would not look like it looked today. Okay, now think about this for a minute. Gaddafi, who went from being our worst enemy, and I'm so old, I remember the Lockerbie thing. So he was our worst enemy in the world. Then he became our friend, right? We still had problems with him, but he dismantled his nuclear program. He didn't do this Iran thing. He actually sent, you know, those centrifuges are sitting in Tennessee, right? He gave it up. He didn't negotiate. He gave it up because he wanted to be part of the world community. We worked with him. He admitted the Lockerbie thing. So when he was having his problems, we knew, and if you guys have read the State Department emails, which is also very interesting, just looking at how the government works, and Donna's trying not to laugh. But if you looked at what happened when Gaddafi was leaving, we knew he was losing control. We knew he was losing power. This was the Arab Spring time, right? You guys all remember that? It was kind of exciting, actually. But when Gaddafi was going, what would have happened if the United States helped identify popular leaders who could bring about change? Right? What if, and this is the pretend world where the CIA lives in before we get in trouble, but what if we had said, okay, there are two guys who the Libyans would like to be in power. And one of them was, right, he was in charge of the interim government, but he lost control. What if we had brought him to the United States or to Turkey or anywhere else and sat him down and said, okay, great soldier, but translating that to running a country, big difference. Let's talk about nation building. Let's talk about how you can put systems in place to be fair to your people. And I realize, again, if anybody who's my age is going Bay of Pigs, you know, Allende, Chile, but it doesn't change the idea here. Had the United States gone in and identify a leader and helped that person train, not somebody that we wanted even, but somebody who the Libyans were working toward, could that have created a situation that was stable? What do you guys think? Could it have worked? Why?
Because it doesn't have to be, we're not trying to nation build, we're just trying to make it stable. Because when the government's stable, they're able to control what's going on within their borders, and we wouldn't have as much room for terrorist groups to grow, their economy would be able to possibly grow stronger, and that would help with stability as well.
And I think you're right. There's a little bit of an ethical dilemma, which is, you know, do we get involved? But, Donna, how long was Gaddafi in power? 40? Ever? Okay. Ever. And when he was in power, he prohibited growth of the intellectual class. Really, he did. He stunted it. And like everybody, every good dictator, he didn't really like dissent. You know, even when he was our friend, we had these few minor human rights issues. So anybody who could be a leader really didn't have the ability to do that. There were no institutions. The problem now is, in Libya, there's no institutions. There's no history. How in the world do you vote when there's no mechanism? There's no ballot box. You know, we worry about electronic voting machines. My friend told me they don't have the ink. You know, the indelible ink you see like in Egypt after they voted? So you're starting so much from scratch that you're almost creating this instability. Come on in. So Libya is something, and we'll talk more about it. I want to hear what you guys think. The second one is Syria, which my guess is you guys all know about, right? So the same deal. Assad's been in power forever, right? His father was in power before him forever. Now, Syria is a little bit different because in all your spare time, you guys, look up what Syria looked like before the war. You know, look at pictures of Syria. Donna, have you been there?
No.
It was a modern city. You know, what do we see now? Rubble. People can't eat. People are starving to death. There's no water. But this was a country where there was a lot of trade. There were a lot of people in and out. However, if you don't like Assad, you're really not going to get the opportunity to build support. Again, he's quashing anybody who is against him. The theory with Syria also, if you guys know the difference in the Arab Springs. When Syria's protests started, you guys know what they wanted? When they very first started? What they want? This was during Arab Spring. You know, everybody wanted Mubarak out. What was going on? What did they want? They wanted Assad to stay. They just wanted to be able to vote. They wanted more say. At the beginning, the demonstrations were peaceful. These were people going out in the square saying, oh, if you don't mind, we'd kind of like a say in our government. So Assad responded by bombing them. And it escalated and escalated. You had the Free Syrian Army and all this stuff. Right after, there was a moment, a friend of mine who was in the embassy there, when Assad first responded by killing his own people, which to me says everything you need to know about Assad. One of his lieutenants defected to Egypt. And now here's the other dirty little truth about politics, in case you guys didn't catch on. This guy is really good looking, really charismatic, very smart. He was educated. He fits what a politician works, because if you're attractive in world politics, except for Donald Trump, you get a lot more attention. And that's just plain old true. Okay, this guy was he had everything that the Syrian people should want. He was part of Assad's inner circle, but he defected. But what that meant is he wasn't too radical. There was problems with the Free Syrian Army. There's problems with the politicians who are in Turkey trying to run the country. So this friend of mine in the embassy, who works for an agency that we shall not name, said, they met with him and said, we have a great idea. How would you like to be the leader of Syria? What we'll do is we'll train you. We'll help you build a support base. You've got all these factions fighting. We're going to call them together. And what we're going to do is get them to work together. We're going to have a big conflict resolution meeting, figure out what the problems are, what you guys all want, and we're going to put you in charge because you're somebody who could beat Assad. Unfortunately, that was illegal because we can't do political covert action. So the meeting went by the wayside. What happened often in U.S. policy happened, which is the guy said, gee, thanks a lot. You promised me something, then pulled it right out from under me. So he really didn't want to work with us anymore. And here we are now in Syria, right? Syria, until Russia decided to get involved, was looking right along that Libya path. Lots of different power centers, nobody really in charge, the people dying in the street, being barrel bombed and killed with chemical weapons. So once again, we had a situation where who's in charge? So let me ask you right now today, what happens if Assad leaves today? Realistically, what happens? What happens?
Sectarian violence.
Yeah. Who does really, really well when there's a vacuum? ISIS is there. ISIS is patient. Al-Nusra is there. Al-Nusra is patient. Okay, so does that mean we should leave Assad?
Maybe.
Maybe? At what cost?
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Lisa Ruth is a former analyst for the CIA. She spoke a few weeks ago at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us today, we're airing a talk given a few weeks ago by Lisa Ruth. She's a former analyst for the CIA and now works as a journalist. The title of her talk is Could Covert Action Have Saved the Middle East? She makes a case for how covert action might have worked to keep Libya and Syria stable.
I have another friend who I once said, okay, you know, yeah, Saddam Hussein was a really bad dictator, but, and he started going, blah, blah, blah. There's no but. You have to stop the sentence that he was a really bad dictator. And it's tempting for me to say, but they kept the lid on sectarian violence. When Mubarak was in power in Egypt, and he was really one of our closest friends, the Christians were protected. Muslims were protected, unless you remember Muslim Brotherhood and then you were illegal. He let the U.S. work with them. He protected Israel. He left, and things went crazy. Now there's al-Sisi in, and we can have another discussion about that sometime. But the point is, when a dictator is there, it does hold the lid on. Gaddafi held the lid on. Assad tried to hold the lid on. But what cost? You know? And that's really the question. That is really the question. I'm going to tell you once before I go about a covert action plan I was involved in. And when things can go right, because this is one we did with the support of a government, the government we were working with. And there was a terrorist group in this particular Middle Eastern country that was coming in. And they were making inroads in the election. But they were illegal. So the government said to us, can you fly somebody in and talk to these people and figure out, you know, how we can do this, how we can help things. So I was 24 at the time. And, you know, we think we know everything. So we flew in. And I'm talking to all these people on the ground and telling them, you know, you don't want those terrible terrorist people. And we're creating small groups and sharing information. So this guy in the back who had, I think he told me he had a second grade education, and he raised his hand and he said, you guys might think we're stupid, but we know what we want. It might not be what you want, but we know what we want. So then the question was, well, what am I doing telling these people what they should want? You know, I come back to Washington in my house, and these guys are worried about water. It raises a lot of questions about covert action. Except there is that idea. Do we need a diplomatic tool between the military and the diplomacy? And if so, what is it? So I'd really like to know what you guys think. What do you think about covert action? What do you think about stability? What are your thoughts? Yes.
I guess what I'm wondering is, like, if we did allow covert political action, like, say something like allowing that lieutenant who defected to take control, what would prevent it from being something like the Bay of Pigs?
Or like or Pinochet.
Chile. Yeah.
Okay. Because we, right, you guys all know, or is this way, way, way too old for you? What happened in Chile? Allende comes in. He's elected in Chile. You guys know this story? This story, right? He's elected. The United States freaks out. Oh, my God, he's a communist, right? We can't have this. And we go in and help. So we get, he commits suicide last minute, and we get Pinochet in. You know how many people Pinochet killed? A lot.
A lot of people.
It disappeared, right? And the United States at the time said, he's a capitalist. He likes us. He's our friend, right? So you're right. What is the trade-off? Let me ask you another. What happens if he gets in? And we had this happen in Cuba. They get in, and they're our friends for a little while, and then they go, you know what, we hate you. We don't want anything to do with the United States. So then does U.S. go back in and say, okay, now your turn's over, we're going to pick somebody else? You know, I don't have that answer. The question, though, is it a legitimate tool? Is it any of our business? How would you guys feel if you found out Putin was giving, you know, again, I'll pick somebody else because I can't keep picking on Trump, Rubio, $100 million. Daniel Craig just gave Bernie Sanders a huge, huge check. And people are going crazy. He's a British citizen. So, covert action. What else? What do you guys think? Would you guys like to be involved in a covert action plan? Yes. Yes?
Thank you. So you mentioned earlier imposing, if you will, Western values on the Middle East, if I could characterize it that way. And in a previous lecture a couple of weeks back, the gal was here from Amir, I think is what it called. And I asked a question regarding whether the notion of nation states, ostensibly the sands and lines in the sand drawn by the British in 1910 or 12 or whenever it was, it may be completely passe for that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And something along nominal fluid tribal lines, which is the, 6,000-year history of the area, is perhaps where it needs to go back. And whether or not these are part of the United Nations in some different form, whether or not there's some type of other economic system, that may be where they're headed. And that's just, and perhaps covert action may help them wander in that direction. Maybe in the long run, the only concern would be, okay, if they want to go off and develop nuclear weapons, then perhaps we need to stunt that growth, if you will, directly or indirectly. But otherwise, if that's what floats their boat, have at it.
Okay, and you've been to America, right? We don't let people do what floats their boat. That's not. No, you had a couple points, and I want to address. One is imposing Western values on the rest of the world. And this is a tough one for me, because I believe human rights, and I believe democracy, whether that's a Western value or whether, I think that's a humanitarian global values, those two things. I was in Guatemala during the Civil War, and I was incredibly fortunate. My job was to go between the rebels and the military and to try to talk to them both about what they wanted. And you would talk to one group, which were, by the way, Harvard grads running the insurgency, but these guys up in the mountains, you talk to the military, you would think they were from different worlds. I mean, the way they saw the world was like this. And you have a lot of that in the Middle East, too. You have tribes living next to each other who view the world completely differently. Don and I were talking about lunch. Within Islam, we talk about the Shias and the Sunnis, but then there's also the Alawites, there's the Wahhabis, there's the Twelvers, there's the Fivers. You know, it's not quite as clear as we want to make it seem. And they have a very, very distinct, very different belief system. So when we try to impose that on them, maybe by creating a nation state like Iraq. I think you're right. I think Iraq is done as a nation the way it was. I think what we're going to have in Iraq is a federal system with Kurds, Sunnis, and Shias each running their own land. Now, who gets the oil-rich parts is going to be the next thing. But I think there might be more and more of that. If Iraq succeeds in doing that, we will have more of that. The question of the covert action, it's, you know, which side you're standing on. And again, my friends who are Marines tell me covert action is a lot more palatable than driving in, you know, whatevers, Humvees. You know, it seems to me there should be choices in between. But I think your point on the Middle East is right. And it's not just the Middle East. Latin America, you know, you go down there and it's everywhere. We have an idea of the world. And the only thing I will tell people is if anybody is going to go into the diplomatic corps or the CIA or anything else, go where you're going first, because the world on the ground is so different than what we learn here. It's mind-boggling. And I was telling Donna at lunch, my first posting was Suriname, which is always the final Jeopardy answer, by the way. Suriname, it's always Suriname. But you know, and I had been up, there was an insurgency there too, and there was a dictatorship at the time. And we were saying things like, oh, you know, Ronnie Brunswick, what we can do is cut him off logistically, and then we'll go to the civil rights. And you go down there, and you're having lunch with this guy. And he's a guy. He's got 12 kids. He's 22 years old. All of a sudden, it's not just on this piece of paper anymore. It's like, he's a real person. And I would tell that to every politician. Go. Before we invade Iraq, go spend 2 weeks there. See what it's really like. Because it's not, and we were just saying, it's not what Fox News or CNN or MSNBC chooses to show you. There's so much more beyond that. And before these people make decisions about going into these countries, I'm getting off on a tangent, but the point is, on the ground, it's a lot different. And it's stuff that is really hard. I think the best thing social media has done, if you have an area of interest, read the stuff that's going on social media. Read the stuff that the people who are there are posting. It will give you a lot of information. There's somebody here.
So along those similar lines, there's a theory that the Middle East is going through its own dark ages, and there are some striking similarities with the dark ages of Europe, but with some of the major differences being that Europe didn't have nuclear weapons or you know, modern military technology, etc. But there is this theory that the underlying causes of all the everything that's going on in the Middle East has just set it up so badly that there's not much we can do from outside, and that they sort of need to figure it out for themselves, and that we should probably just leave them to it. That's a complicated answer to it, but it's just, I mean, you look at the underlying causes and it's like, well, what can we do about these? I mean, there's really not much we can do about the, I mean, it would be super hard to redraw the lines that the British set down. I mean, however arbitrary and destructive those lines are, but it's so difficult to go against the culture of tribalism and the addiction to oil that they have, and the extreme ideology, and it's super difficult to see any kind of solution there. So, I mean, what do you do?
Can you make the same argument about the United States? I mean, you know, tribalism and strong ideology. No, I agree with you, and I start off, again, another huge joke. I do a lot of TV. And every time they say to me, oh, we've got the situation in Yemen, what do you think? I always say, you know, it's complicated. Because, you know, Syria, it's complicated. And you're absolutely right. The problem, I think, is we have to start being a little bit more creative. And to me personally, the answer is we have to start looking at creating coalitions in the region to solve problems. Because you're right. I studied international relations for a long time. I think I know a lot about it. And I still sit down with my friends who we're talking about, who are Arab Muslims. And they'll say something that just blows me away because I didn't even think of that. My brain just doesn't work that way. I think I'm culturally sensitive. I think I know this stuff. I'm not living in Egypt, in Cairo. The real issue for me with the Middle East is, or anywhere, is what I just said, human rights and democracy. I do believe, and this is not a right or wrong thing, so don't put this on your essay. I do believe that we have a responsibility at some level. I do believe as a superpower we have a responsibility. And I'm not just talking about, you're saying nuclear weapons. Terrorism is a real problem. The fact that if you, in my opinion, if you allow a safe haven, like what is now happening in Libya, like what happened in Afghanistan, you allow terrorist groups to make plans, collect weapons, and take actions that could potentially harm the United States. So even if your only thought is for the United States. Beyond that, though, there is a question of helping, and it gets very, very convoluted. The only agency in the U.S. government that will not hire former CIA, actually there's two, one is the Peace Corps, and one is USAID. And the reason they won't do it is, you know, when we go overseas, I never go overseas as CIA. I'm always State Department or DOD or we have this thing called a NOC, which is called non-official cover. So I would go over as a United Airlines employee, and I'd work in the United Airlines office. And USAID won't hire us because then everybody who's USAID, they're going to think is really CIA. And it's the same thing with the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps can't risk having somebody PNG'd because they think they're CIA. So they just won't hire us. USAID really does, on the ground, incredible things to help people, help countries. They really, really do. And, you know, so I have friends who are Marines who think that the best solution for the Middle East is basically go, blow them up, get rid of all of them, and then start over. Okay, that's just not going to work. Then I have friends in USAID who say, it's actually not that hard if we would listen, but we're not listening. Because in Yemen, Sunnis and Shias worship in the same mosques. Well, if you're watching news today, you would think that Sunnis and Shias would be, as soon as they see each other, would whip out a machine gun and kill each other on the spot. We were talking about Nigeria, North and South. You know, Muslim and Christian. If you listen to the Boko Haram thing, you think that these people are in the streets killing each other, hate each other. Actually, there is a lot of intermarrying. There is a lot of communities that work together. How can we take this writ large? What we just said about the U.S., we're a humongous country. You know how hard it is to rule this country? How many different ethnic groups do we have here? How many different languages do we have here? How many different belief systems do we have here? Why does it work?
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, we're broadcasting a talk given a few weeks ago by a journalist and former analyst for the CIA, Lisa Ruth. She spoke on the subject of conflicts in the Middle East and specifically if American covert action could have prevented the violence and turmoil we see in places like Libya and Syria today. Lisa Ruth works as a journalist for the media organization Communities Digital News and contributes to Newsmax and other publications. Her talk was recorded before last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. She spoke and answered questions from students at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah on October 7th.
What's missing between all these different divisions in the Middle East and those parts of Africa you mentioned is the identity is divided. They feel like they identify more with
that certain group, whether it be religious or tribal, than the country as a whole. Mm-hmm. Whereas everyone in the United States, we feel like, I'm sure for the most part, we identify as Americans or as citizens of the United States or whatever it may be. But we can also be Muslim, we can also be Christian, mm-hmm. we can also be Hispanic or European. So we value all those things that come in together, and it makes us stronger because we have that larger identity we're going towards. Which it kind of leads to a question I have of how can we combat that in the Middle East and Africa, but also what can we do about extreme ideology that is driving those divisions? Because like you said, if you look back at these countries and areas, they were doing fine not too long ago. Mm-hmm. It's the more extreme part of the ideology that needs to be stopped and killed, because it's, you can kill terrorists, but that idea that spawns new ones is always going to be there. So how can we fix that?
Yeah, ISIS to me is particularly interesting, because ISIS was not a bottoms-up organization. It's not something that just created itself. It really was top-down from some of these al-Qaeda groups. The problem, and this is what you guys are all going to have to figure out. I'm retired. But it is. The idea of extremism, and did you guys see after the State Department, when she made the statement that she said the problem with ISIS is they don't have jobs, and everybody ridiculed her? In my opinion, I absolutely have seen that, and I've seen exactly what you're saying. If somebody has a family and somebody has buy-in, you know, is what we call, you've got a mortgage, and you're relevant, your voice is heard, you can vote, you're included. You might be radical, but it's within a box about this big. You know, it's the people who are disenfranchised. It's the people who have nothing to lose where you get these extremes. And this goes back to the dictatorship question, because to me, yes, they kept the lid on, but it was bubbling pretty hard underneath for a long time. And that bubbling is what caused this extremism. Do you guys know how CIA recruits people? You know, when they talk about a spy, I was never a spy. I was a case officer, right? The CIA is not spies. What the CIA does is goes overseas, and we find people to give us information. So if I'm in this room and I desperately want the inside information on what's going on at the Hinckley, right? I'm looking around. I'm going to figure out who's got access to that information. And then I'm going to start seeing what I can learn about you. I'm going to spot you, and then I'm going to assess you. And I'm going to figure out who's got the information but is unhappy. Got passed over for a promotion. Didn't get named student body president. Right? What's the vulnerability? And then I'm going to say, you like Nike? I like Nike too. Maybe not quite like that, but you start doing things with them. You know, the reason I sail now is I spent 12 weeks on a sailboat pretending to love sailing so that I could happen to run into this person I was recruiting, right? When you're recruiting sources, the United States is tough, right? Because we were just joking about Trump, but think about it seriously. What, even if you were mad at the government, and I complain about the government all the time, what would it take for you to commit treason? What would it take for you to sell secrets to a foreign government? I mean, can you even imagine such a thing, really? Because it goes back to what you said, because we're Americans. Places like the Middle East, even though the terrorist target is almost impossible, impossible to recruit. I don't know anybody who's ever recruited a terrorist. I will recruit somebody who recruits somebody who recruits somebody who knows a terrorist. Terrorists are absolutely the hardest threat, the hardest recruitment threat, because they believe. Not because they believe in the religion, but because they believe that these people care about them. It's the same reason that motorcycle gangs in this country are extremely difficult to penetrate. They believe these people care about them, and that they're relevant, and that they have a voice, and that they have a chance. It's the inclusion thing. So until we can figure out, you know, how do you include that writ large? Instead of it being ISIS, how do you make it Syria? You know, how do you create that? I'll tell you one more CIA story. Poor Donna's going to hear this again. But there's one country in the world that the United States has never had a unilateral agent, which means they're always a double agent. It always turns out they are pretend to be working for us, but really then they're reporting back to their government what we are telling them, what we're asking. Because you can get, if they know what we want to know, they know a lot about what we're looking at. There's one country in the world that every agent has been a double agent. Any guesses?
Canada.
No. Cuba. We've never had an agent. And it used to make my Cuban counterparts crazy, just about as much as every year when they were saying, Castro's dying this year. Because from the American perspective, we're like, but it's Cuba. They're terrible to you. You don't have these opportunities. You've got all these problems. And I'm not talking about the Cubans who left, because I live in Florida, and trust me, those Miami Cubans would turn on Castro in 2 seconds. But the Cubans who are still there believe Castro cares about them. And they'll tell you, not to Americans, but they will admit, you know, yeah, the economy's kind of rough, all that. But they believe that he stood up to the United States for them. He gave up all this stuff for them. You know, and we just, Americans have this such wrong idea. We're like, but it's Cuba. How can you do that? So until we can figure out a way to help create these boundaries. And the funny thing to me about Libya is it's not even tribal. They are gangs. They create a neighborhood gang, you know, the 45th Street gang. And now we're going to be in charge right here. And what we're going to do is we're going to give you guns, and we're going to give you money, and we're going to make you chief of the block. And these guys will stay there.
You asked about whether there are unbiased views on the media. And when it comes to mind, periodically I will watch Frontline.
We were just talking about that.
They had, in my estimation, an interesting program called Putin's Way that came out in January this year. One, another piece of background, and I'm taking a Russian culture class this semester, and we're talking about 900s to 1800s. And where I'm going with this is it appears that, and Putin, in my estimation, is basically each day paints himself into more and more of a corner, and he really has no way out. He has no place to go on the planet other than in the ground. So that's what's motivating where he's at. He's an opportunist. Strategically, Russia only has two places on the planet that really, really concern them. One is Crimea, because it's a huge military complex base, one. Secondly, the reason they're involved in Syria, in my estimation, is because they have a naval repair station there.
TARDIS.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't think they have any real friends on the planet. So that's why I'm guessing that they're in Syria. So given that, if one goes with this assumption that Putin is basically another dictator, a czar, as it's labeled in the Frontline program, and I encourage you to watch that. And they have no history other than a few small experiments in self-governance in Nizhny Novgorod in 1200s and maybe one or two other places. But the czar put it down. They have no history for self-governance. And that's another one of these areas on the planet, sixth landmass of the planet, that don't have what we would call Western values. They have no idea what self-governance is like that you have in Western Europe. How would we try to make some positive influence so that they are reasonably stable in whatever state that they will be in the future?
Well, first thing is they'd say they're very stable today, right now. The thing about Putin, I'd be curious what your professor says about this. If you go to Russia, Russians can take poverty. Russians can take cold. Russians can take insults. What they cannot stand is, what I just said is lie. They cannot stand insults. They cannot take disgrace. They will take a lot of pain. So right now, you've got a situation, the economy is a disaster. People are hurting. I talked to my friend, the KGB guy. He says, I know, can you believe it? The United States is so stupid. I said, what do you mean the United States is so stupid? They insulted Putin. Like, I mean, we're talking about Russia. He's like, oh, yeah, we're going to be fine. The thing is, you got to stop talking mean about Putin. You got to stop it. That's insulting. Don't insult us that way. You know, his popularity numbers, I think 2 months ago, were at an all-time low at 88%. And this is not just what he says. This is, you stop people on the streets. Putin is also a KGB officer. Don't forget that. And he was a really good KGB officer. Putin, I've heard him compared to a chess player. He's not a chess player. Putin's a poker player. And the problem for the United States is that he knows exactly what our hand looks like. And he's willing to bluff and bluff and bluff because he knows what we will not do. I think another reason he may be in Syria, and I completely agree with you, I think it's a situation, he wants the naval base. But I also think it's more than that. We have a history, again, Grenada, anyone. When things start getting bad domestically, we, as a human population, look for an outside enemy. And that brings us back to being Americans. Oh my gosh, those terrible Grenadians, you know, Bishop could invade at any moment. So if we've got an outside enemy, then all of a sudden we're all Americans. You know, during World War II, we were all Americans. The other thing Putin is doing, look at Egypt. After Mubarak, after we had this disaster, El-Sisi's in now. Russia sold them weapons that the United States was not yet willing to sell because we weren't sure what was going on with stability. Russia has courted Egypt. If you look at places where the United States used to have very strong presence, where there's been a little bit of an opening, Putin has gone in. Look at what he's done. He's creating a naval base, he says, in Venezuela and Cuba. My friends in Nicaragua tell me last week there was a Russian warship there. That's not that far. It's farther from you guys, closer when I'm in Florida. What Putin is doing is showing strength. Russia does not like weakness. The culture is being strong. You can bluff, but bluff hard, you know? And I think some of what he's doing is showing he is strong. Russia is strong. And again, without debating about the current administration, whether you agree with what they're doing or not, the international view is the United States has pulled back. The international view is that the United States is not prepared to bomb Syria when we say there's a line in the sand. And again, my friends in the administration tell me there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot went into it. To the Syrians, it doesn't matter. Russia is filling a void in the Middle East that is, at least perception-wise, that the United States has left open. Putin is so many things, and the biography that came out on him is fascinating. He's OCD, you know, off the charts. He can't have personal relationships. He really can't. He cares about Russia. He cares about his job. He cares about the perception of Russia internationally. And I think that's what he's doing. And the fact is, the Russian people, they'd like bread, but meanwhile, they take a lot of pride. You know, and people talk a lot about Putin saying that the worst mistake of the 20th century was the Soviet Union breakup. He says he didn't mean it exactly the way it sounded. But most Russians will tell you that. Not from a Soviet thing, but they lost something. They had this big country, and they lost it. It's a psychological issue. But I also agree with the military base in TARDIS.
Earlier you had asked if covert action in Libya or Syria would have helped out.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have intelligence units in both of those countries. Like SCG International was there. They were embedded with militias and with military organizations. So why did their assessments or their intelligence gathering not help out with
there's big difference.
Our interests?
There's a couple things. First of all, we did have intelligence. We had really bad intelligence. We had a lot of military intelligence that was there. And military intelligence is great at military intelligence. They are really, really good at it. The issue became information that was not objective. And again, for everything else, what every other agency will say about the CIA, we never had an objective. When I was overseas, I was collecting information. I didn't have something to, I wasn't trying to do it. And in fact, I always felt badly for the State Department because the State Department was supporting U.S. policy. Half the time, I never even knew what U.S. policy was. That is true. I was collecting information. And what happened in Syria and in Libya was information was so fragmented and we didn't have really strong sources on the ground. So we were relying on military and a lot on private contractors, which is a bad, bad thing. The CIA got cut back pretty heavily. We lost a lot of human capability, which is another thing that I personally champion. Overhead photography, listening devices, you're not going to get the same thing that you're going to get from a person. You're just not. And when we cut it way back, it's very hard to go back in. And tonight I'm talking about Iran. The CIA has a way of validating sources. We have reliability and access. So the best source in the world is a generally reliable source with excellent access. You can only get that if you pass a polygraph. A generally reliable source is passed a polygraph. How am I going to give a polygraph to a Syrian during war? Okay, I'm not. I'm going to carry it around on my back. All right, we can't do it. And we had this problem in Iran. The other thing is, like with terrorists, they consistently beat the polygraph because there is a different view of what's okay and what's not. So we didn't really have sources. We didn't have anybody who was a vetted source. And because we hadn't developed sources, then you can't go on the ground and go, hi, I'd really like you to tell me all your secrets if you don't mind. So we didn't have time to catch up. This is what's happening in Iraq today. It's what's happening in Libya. It's what's happening in Syria. We're operating with one eye closed. And the other thing is collecting intelligence is very different than covert action. And we're not doing it.
I just want to thank you so very much again. Can we give her a round of applause?
Thank you, guys.
Thank you today to Lisa Ruth, who is a journalist and editor for Communities Digital News and a regular contributor to Newsmax. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble producer and curator for this program. Thanks for listening.